This is episode 17 with guests Marcus Anthony and Jerome Glenn.
Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. I am the president of Haku Global. This is a space for globally minded experts to dialogue about the future of leadership with a focus on the key question, how can leadership be more intelligent about futures? From this conversation, innovative wisdom, practical tools, and actionable insights emerge to help future-ready leaders thrive in an uncertain, complex, and exponentially changing world. Let's jump in to the dialogue.
Aloha and welcome to this episode of the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. Today's co-guests are Jerome Glenn and Marcus Anthony. Jerome is the executive director of the Millennium Project with a focus on creating a sustainable global collective intelligence system and also houses the largest collection of internationally peer-reviewed methods for exploring the future. Jerome specializes in global futures research, global scenarios, and strategies to address global challenges. He manages a participatory think tank of 63 nodes around the world that conduct futures research on science, and technology, environment, energy, and collective intelligence. Marcus is an associate professor of future studies at the Beijing Institute of Technology. He writes books, articles, and popular pieces about the future and gives public talks and workshops. He likes to explore deep futures, profound, meaningful, and sustainable visions of tomorrow. He is also the coordinator of the Global Talent 2050 platform and the Foresight Advisor for the Research and Development Center for Future Civilizations. In this dialogue, we discuss collective intelligence, the importance of feedback and challenges of information overload, the importance of intelligence, wisdom, and deep embodiment, the role of intuition and logic for decision-making about the future, how levels-based systems create inherent bias, and how spherical systems help to overcome bias, and the need for more cognitive diversity in the future. Let's listen. So thank you, Jerome and Marcus, for joining me today on this episode. And as always, I want to start with this key question of what does it mean or how can leadership be more intelligent about the future given this climate of uncertainty, complexity, and exponential change? I'd love for you both to answer this from your own perspective and your own work. I'd like to start with Jerome.
Well, if you're going to be more intelligent in the future, then you got to have some kind of intelligent system. And because the rate of change and complexity and interdependency and all of that is increasing so much, you really have to have some kind of collective intelligent system. When I say collective intelligence, I mean the synergies between human brains, information, and software that produce just-in-time information on an ongoing basis than these elements acting alone. We have one online collective intelligence system called the Global Futures Intelligence System, and it has a framework of 15 global challenges. We keep track of the news and scanning and models and all kinds of other sorts of stuff on an ongoing basis, so you can dip into it at any old time, do searches and things like that. So if you're going off to a meeting on, let's say, the future of water, you stick in water and you see how water goes across the whole system and what's the interdependencies of water in a lot of areas you might not have thought about. So I would say that's one factor. Another factor on that is to collect information through as many different viewpoints as possible. Not everybody's right about everything. Not everybody's wrong about everything. And a leader then also should act through all these categories. I think future leaders will not just be political leaders or corporate leaders. Like Elon Musk is clearly a corporate leader. But imagine future leaders are those that sort of have one foot in the political world, one foot in the business world, and he has more feet. Another foot in the academic world, and another foot in the NGO world, and another foot, let's say, in international organizations or UN organizations, so that you can act through all those organizations. Because one of the idea of management is, you know, getting work done through others. So a leader can manage his leadership through different institutions. So you don't just pick one avenue to lead in. You could lead in a variety of avenues, so to speak.
No, very good. Very good insights. Thanks, Jerome. And Marcus, from your perspective and your work, how do you answer the question?
Well, I'm hoping that me and Jerome can find some resonance here, because Jerome has much more experience in the broader field of future studies working with organizations than I do. I classify myself as a futurist, but I work in a quite a different way. I do work in an organization. I do a lot of international conferences and writing. When it comes to the idea of intelligence, I agree with Jerome definitely that I think leaders need a foothold with multiple stakeholders, and that they need to be able to listen to people and get a variety of inputs. So that's certainly very, very important. And I guess maybe I'll start off and I'll throw this out there, is that, you know, I think we should ask what intelligence actually is. And I basically think intelligence in the broader sense is the ability to solve problems within specific contexts. And so in other words, how you solve it or the process that you use to solve it is not necessarily the important thing, but it's in fact, it's getting there in the end. And if different people use different processes or different sources of information, maybe even different ways of knowing. So one of the things I'm really interested in is different ways of knowing. So when I did my research, I was interested in alternative ways of knowing, contrasting mainstream theories of intelligence, which tend to focus on verbal and linguistic and mathematical and logical processes, which are typical ways of looking at intelligence, with intuitive intelligence, including things that might be more associated with spirituality and mysticism. I know Jerome also has some interest in that, because I've looked at some of his work. And so to sum up, I'm quite interested in the ways that people come to information. And if most organizations, I think, are big data these days. Okay. And I guess one more point I would put out is, what are the limitations of big data, given that data has to be drawn basically from the present or the past? The intuitive mind may give us an edge into the future that's perhaps not examined as much as it could be in organizations. So I'll kind of leave it off there for the moment.
Yeah, it's very interesting points. I mean, it reminds me of looking at, I don't know if you're familiar with Dr., I think his name's Eagleman, in his work on like augmented sensory information, where you could wear a vest that's hooked into the stock market and get all this sensory feeling, and then that would somehow over time you'd learn how to translate that into the changes in the stock market and make decisions based on the feeling that was created from the vest. You know, pretty interesting like ideas. But yeah, with your work, Jerome, how are you using technology and data from the past, but getting the insights on the future?
Well, I'd like to build on Mark's comments about the intuition part.
Great.
My undergraduate degree was in philosophy, and I noticed that, and most of my focus was on the history of philosophy, and I noticed that one of the common threads throughout all philosophy was the respect paid to intuition. And so I try to figure out, what the hell is intuition anyway? And there's a lot of views about intuition, but one of the views that I think is acceptable is that when someone says, you know, how'd you get to that? Says, well, that was my gut reaction. That was my gut feeling, whatever. And to me, it means that there are so many things that went into that insight that it would take you too long to explain. And there's so much into it, you'd forget where you were in the middle of the explanation anyway. So you just simply say, that's my gut reaction. So I don't, now some, of course, others will say that you're hooking into a universal mind or something like that. And that may be, I don't know. It's certainly a wonderful way to view the world, whether it's true or not, is another question, but it's certainly a good aesthetic perception. But in any case, I would throw out the idea that intuition might also be quite analytical in the conventionals. It's just so much. I would add to this, just a little point of historic note on that, is in the early days of the RAND Corporation, they had to try to make futures speculation respectable. which is not completely, as Marcus knows, in the academic world, it's not completely accepted yet. Mm-hmm. In any case, it was less accepted then. And sometimes there was a guy named Herman Kahn who had the highest recorded IQ at the time. And he would sometimes make pronouncements, and they would often be quite insightful, quite intuitive, etc. And you couldn't simply say Herman said as a method. So they called it genius forecasting. Hmm. And after Herman died, almost nobody used the word genius forecasting anymore. But intuition has always been a problem, how to know when to trust and when not to trust. And I think there may be methods in it, but that gets a bit fancy. Happy to go into that if you want to, but I just wanted to jump in a little bit on the intuition part.
And no, I think that's, and I think it's really important. I mean, that's, interestingly, I also went to graduate school in philosophy.
Oh, good.
And and interestingly,
do you agree with that the common thread is intuition?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it just comes down to that, right? At some point, that's just where that maybe their insight originated, right? And then from that, they develop a logical explanation or analysis.
Yeah, the classic way we used to explain it was when we talked about all deduction is based upon inductive conclusions, right? All men are mortal, right? So then you say in the old green apple example, well, is it the fourth green apple or the fifth green apple when you say all green apples are sour? Well, that's intuition. There's nothing, you know, there's no rule about that.
Right. You just kind of make it up, right? Do you have anything to add to that, Marcus?
Oh. Well, I think Jerome was on the right track there when he says that people it can have intuitions, and then one way to proceed from there is then to test them out into the real world, or then to apply rationality or the empirical, if you like. And of course, if you're a leader of an organization, you have to speak the language of the clientele, and if you're an academic, you have to speak the language of people in organizations. And if you go too far out of field, I think it was John Naisbitt that said, if you get too far ahead of the parade, no one will see where you are. So you have to try to bring it down into the real world. But a lot of well-known leaders famously trust intuition in some ways, at least on some occasions above more standard forms of knowing. Now, Steve Jobs apparently did that. He went to India when he was very young, and he said he learned an appreciation for some of the Indian ways of knowing, including the intuitive. And he would say sometimes something like, you know, he would have market research, but then if his gut feeling didn't align with it, he would then just ditch it. And it's interesting that, you know, Ford, you know, who invented the process of producing mass amounts of motor cars, he said famously that if you listen to the customer all the time, then I did market research, then he would probably just be developing a faster horse, because that's what they would do.
That's right. And picking up on your leadership theme, since when is a leader following? I mean, to me, a leader is ahead of the motion, which brings me back to a nice point, Marcus. You made the comment about being ahead of the parade. And that is, yes, always a problem. Every day we struggle with that issue. However, I think one mode of future leadership could simply say, look, I'm sorry, I'm ahead of the parade, I'm not going to slow down, that's just the way it is, but there are people who recognize what you're doing, and you can lead through those others so that you can help other leaders that are more connected to the conventional way of understanding.
So in that sense, it's about finding your audience or your foothold in the situation. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Just personally, I've been in startup space, and a lot of times where it's like I don't even try to convince my business partner. I just have a gut feeling on something, and I just start doing it, and then it ends up, you know, that he follows along, you know, at some point. I think it's hard though for leaders to lead that way in a lot of spaces. And so how can they do that?
Yeah, let me give you another slice of that. As you may know, the Millennium Project is a pretty complex think tank. Got 65 nodes around the world and all kinds of different stuff. And so to manage that is essentially impossible. It's way too complex to manage it in a normal sense. So the way that I sometimes answer the question on that is the Tai Chi. Mm-hmm. And in Tai Chi, not simply the simple exercise that you do, but the push hands one. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. instead of doing push hands with one person, imagine doing it spherically. So there's some above you, some below you, some to the right, some to the left, and so forth. And you're pushing and pulling back at different speeds with different people in different ways all the time, so that you're always at an optimum leadership at that moment, so to speak, because you can't lead so much that you break a system. On the other hand, if you're not pushing a bit, you're not leading.
Yes, that's a good point. And of course, your situation, Jerome, is that you work with a lot of people. It's quite complex. For me, it's much more simple because I tend to have a smaller framework, even though I am associated with a broader network of people.
How do you see that working in your space then, Marcus?
Which point are you particularly referring to?
Just how to lead when there are like multiple pieces going on, and also leading with that kind of gut feeling, not always having to justify it.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, developing trust with people is really important. You know, if you're an intuitive leader and you've developed some trust, then people are more likely to go with you, and you've shown that you've been able to do something. If you haven't developed that trust, they might just see this person as a bit wacky, for example. In my current organization, I've had three different bosses, and the one that was in the middle that lasted about 2 years, I won't go too much into it, but he brought in from Hong Kong a flat organizational structure. So he basically walked in, and he was quite consciously a Taoist as well. So he would look at people and say, okay, you're interested in this, you develop your programs along those lines. So in my case, I'd spent 2 years in this organization basically marking English papers, which is a complete waste of my capacity because the previous boss wouldn't listen to me. But he came in and he saw me and says, ah, you're a futurist. Okay, you go there. So now I'm developing future studies programs. I'm doing a platform called Global Talent 2050. So he gave me permission to be able to do that. So I can use my position within that that framework to lead it. And people often don't ask me, why are we going in this direction? But I think I've developed some level of trust. But I was trusted in the first place by the leader.
What was his, he stayed only for 2 years. Was there something that happened along the way that he lost trust with people? Or?
Okay, we'll see how this part goes. You know, the changes in China in recent years, he was pretty much a radical. So he came up and he set up an honors college, which is another college in the same institution. I work in the Beijing Institute of Technology, Zhuhai campus. There goes a thunderclap there. That could be a sign. maybe it's the party, I don't know. No, I just want to quickly finish that.
Yeah.
So he set up this college where basically let students develop their own programs with minimum grading, developing their own projects and projects in work. He did the same thing in our college, which is in the same university, but it's a separate college of 1,000 students. And so he set that up, a pretty flat organization with one big guy in the middle, which is basically him, but that's how it often works. And so that was a really interesting thing in China to be able to do this kind of thing. And some people may not have been overly impressed with that, and so he had some conflicts, and now he's gone.
Was it pretty successful though, from your opinion?
Well, that's a good question. I really think it was a fantastic thing, and you need more than 2 years, or actually 1.5 years, to be able to make changes. You've got to follow through things. What I've seen as an educator is that people bring in new ideas, and they ditch them after like a year or two. And part of the skill is just hanging in there. You know, success is, you know, just being part of the game. And in this case, we didn't see it through. But I thought I saw some really positive changes. And a lot of the more innovative staff were really happy with what was going on. They really got to develop their careers, the younger staff as well. So I think it was really good for the students and the team altogether. But unfortunately, the experiment didn't last long enough to see a long term. But it has planted seeds in people. Yeah. So I think that's an important thing to remember.
Have you seen that, Jerome? Have you seen a much implementation of like a more flat kind of individual empowerment type of leadership or organizational structure?
Well, as anybody that's been to any of a Money and Project Planning Committee meetings can tell you, I get overruled all the time. I mean, I could tell you all kinds of stories. That's why I'm talking about the idea of participatory Tai Chi management. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. So I think of it more spherical than I do flat. Mm. I mean, flat, sort of a flat perception, you know? Think of a neuron, you know, a neuron gets its information spherically and fires spherically, mostly in one direction, but spherically. And spherical, it just gives you just much more of a richness of action than flat, I think.
Well, and so how does that, I mean, I know you gave the example of the push hands in the Tai Chi. Yeah. Are there some other practical examples of this kind of spherical model? Because I'm very interested in it personally. I did a Bagua martial arts training. And so Bagua uses a lot of centripetal and centrifugal forces, you know, and it's a lot of like a dance, right? So same kind of thinking, I think, is there. And Marcus in China, I'm sure there's some of that still, that kind of thinking as well.
Then going on with the martial art language, sometimes you want to do judo. Mm-hmm. You use the, let's say if somebody, I won't mention situations, but sometimes somebody wants to stop you and you're a threat or whatever it happens to be. So you engage that force in judo and go with it and have it move against itself. Right. Mm-hmm. So in some leadership styles of that, you're using judo. Sometimes some things are so important that no matter what the response is, no matter where the chips may fall, you're going to do the karate approach, all force to one spot. Mm. Right. Now that's another leadership style. That's sort of like in the U.S. Civil War, they had Grant. Grant's management style was all force to one spot, rushing right through. No style, no nothing. But that's okay sometimes, and sometimes it's. But I like the push hands more because I think every one of us can improve, and so like I get pushed as well. So that's why I like the push hands example. It's not just me pushing you; it's you pushing me too, and the two of us make each other stronger. So and spherical, I guess, because. You know, stuff comes into us from all directions. And I had no idea the Red Cross was going to call up in this virus situation and say, can you give the U.S. scenarios? That came in from, you know, left field, so to speak. But then when we draw on stuff, all of a sudden I'm drawing on different locations of the U.S. government and all that sort of stuff. Spherical is a nice model because it has a sense of defeating the concept of levels. Philosophically, psychologically rather than philosophical. There's a lot of people philosophically that have level theory of the universe and all that sort of stuff, and state level is lower than the federal level and so forth. And that bothers me. What I'd rather think is a spherical thing so that you don't have level, because levels may very well be true, but they tend to pass on unconscious prejudice. That which is lower level is inferior to that which is higher level. And we're passing on prejudice from one generation to the next without realizing it. But spherical, you don't have that same sense of built-in prejudice.
That's a good point, Jerome. I remember Michael Jackson, I don't know if you might know who Michael Jackson is, he's a futurist who runs Shaping Tomorrow.
I just had him on the show just before you guys.
Oh, okay, interesting. he told you the story maybe 20 years ago or something. He was in banking and they were looking at the next big thing basically, and they had I can't remember the specifics of the story, but basically they were talking about what's coming up, and one of the team members, it might have been Mike, were down in like the photocopy room or something, and decided to ask someone down there, and I said, oh yeah, the next big thing, it'll be the internet. And I think it was Mike Ripper, I said, what is the internet? You know? So that's a really good example of how listening to people is a pretty good thing. And, listening is important. Keep going, Jerome.
Yeah, building on that, we created a collective intelligence system for the Kuwait Oil Company. And the one of the key criteria is set, by the way, the chairman of the Kuwait Oil Company, that everybody, whether they're a janitor, driver, driller, engineer, no matter what they were, the system ought to be such that their two bits can be put into the whole and be considered in the same way the new piece of information comes into your brain and be considered across the board. So that was actually a system that was based upon that idea of the Xerox machine, so to speak.
I'm curious what you both think about this idea of exploring, of using this kind of spherical understanding or model for exploring the future. Do you have any insights on that?
Well, assuming that the future is more complex in the future than the past, having the spherical, actually, let me sort of do a parallel to that. I used to do futuristic education a bunch of years ago. And one of the techniques was actually coined by one of the students, fifth grade student, called Me According to Me. It was a variation on the futures wheel. The person would put themselves in the middle, and they draw little lines out. You know, this was a line for mathematics. This was a line for being friendly. This was a line for, you know, exercise. But you have all these little lines going out, the different aspects of you. And if you were perfect in your judgment on that one area, you would be drawn out to 10, the length of 10, whatever 10 was. And if you are really not too good, it might be drawn out 2. So imagine all these spokes at different lengths and then connect them up. And that's you according to you. So the idea was you develop yourself spherically. And part of the area idea, but I don't think it was ever done, was if you took these patterns of all the students and lay them in a little computer program so that you'd be matched up with students where you are better than they are, so to speak, in one area and inferior to them in another area. So your interaction makes both of you spherically more developed. So you could do this with a corporation. Yeah, you can do this with a country. We do a state of the future index. As a matter of fact, this was done in China. We did a state of the future index for a bunch of years, since 2000, the year 2000 or so. And we've done them for countries. And China's been doing it itself a bit. And what they did is that we used to have a little index, a 20-year graph, and then going out 10 years. So you show what would improve the situation. Well, what they did is they laid it out like I talked about that Me According to Me. They did little spokes out of the different variables for China. I think they did it for a province. And then they hooked it up so they could compare the pattern over years.
Very interesting.
That's interesting. I don't, I'm not particularly familiar with that process. But one thing I do remember, which may be related, is the, you know, I had many years ago, a kind of a spiritual teacher who said something to me, which I always remember this. And she said that if you're sitting in a room or at a table, always look at the person who's sitting opposite you. She said, because they have something to teach you and they're there for a reason. Now, you can look at that as metaphorical or metaphysical, but I did always remember that. And so I think it's a part of this listening process or observing and making sure that you incorporate the and find connections with people who may be different, which can be an issue in the age of the internet and e-bubbles as well.
Yeah, true.
Before I forget, there's if I can, I noticed in your literature, you have using the word intelligence and the word wisdom. And here's an oversimplification, and I know there's tons of contradictions to what I'm about to say, but a generalization. I see data as something you can count, not always, but in general, something you can count. Information is the pattern of the data. Knowledge is the meaning of the information. Intelligence is the action, what act you do with the knowledge. And wisdom is when you do the act.
Yeah, I certainly agree that action is an important part of intelligence. Like I said, it's the ability to be able to do things and be successful as you're doing them. Yes.
Yeah, I like how you lay that out in that kind of pattern, because it is important to make distinction between these things, because we forget that data information aren't really always useful, you know, if they don't have that intelligence or wisdom behind them. And I think a lot of leadership's looking for more data and information, but then sometimes they miss out on the intelligence and the wisdom part of it. Marcus, from your perspective, can you expand more on the intelligence part and action and how that relates to what you understand in foresight and futures?
I developed an idea called integrated intelligence, which is a bit out there, but basically it's the idea that intelligence, as I mentioned, contains both rational and intuitive components. And the intuitive aspect has mundane intuition, which is body-centered, physiological, but also a kind of a spiritual knowing as well, which I consider to be valid, and not all cultures do, so there can be a bit of a problem with selling that idea. But I think it's really important that we gain embodiment, because I think the human body is an important component of intelligence. And if you thrust too much information at people and you get them to spend too much time on computers, what I call computer rationality, then they start to become disembodied and lose touch with the body and with presence. And that's a really, really very, very important thing for human beings. And once they start to disconnect from that, then I think all kinds of problems arise with mental health and just people losing touch with who they are. I think this is a civilizational issue at this time in history. Mm. And it's a very, very important thing, which is perhaps not quite understood. So I think we need to keep an eye on that as we move forward.
Any follow-up thoughts on that, Jerome?
Yeah, what was reacting in my mind on that is I used to do something I should do again. I used to put a rope between a couple of doorknobs in the place I was living in the past. And I'd get on the rope and sort of balance myself. Hmm. And there's a lot of heavyweight ethical issues in futures research. And, so, you know, you can make the case sometimes on both sides so well that you just don't know what the heck to do. And so analysis sort of breaks down. Mm. And so when I was in that situation, sometimes I'd get on this rope and I'd sort of balance. And I'd notice as I was thinking the thoughts, what I was feeling and how I was about, like what threw me off balance and what helped me balance. Mm-hmm. And I call this sort of a method called phelesis. You have analysis, you break things into parts and you use, you know, if then logic and all that sort of stuff. Whereas phelesis is sort of like feeling about feeling. It's sort of like the synthesis of that sort of, it's just the analog to analysis. And that the technique of doing it, that particular one, was on a rope. The reason I'm bringing this up because when Marcus said the body is involved in the game, well, I actually use my body as part of that game because there's a nervous system. It does influence my muscles. My mind influences the brain and they're all interdependent. So in the act of trying to balance, you know, wobbling around, I was integrating those factors and then trying to notice what it was what I was thinking or feeling at the moment of getting back into balance. You know, that may have been just nonsense, but it was an interesting way to take a break.
No, maybe it's a good way to get in touch with your body as well and your feelings. So.
Right. No, I think I love how you brought this up, Marcus and Jerome, because this it's interesting to me on many levels. There's, you know, definitely a lot of research and around, you know, the idea of even like AI and how it might not, it's not learning the same way as a human learns because the brain is, you know, embedded in a body. And there's something unique about that in the process of it developing and growing. And also I'm really interested in this idea of embodied knowledge, but also disembodied knowledge. But we have a lot of information out there and knowledge in the world that's not connected to a person, like it was in the past where we didn't have, you know, clouds of information. Mm-hmm. And also how one interesting thing for me is one of my hobbies or interests is yoga. And I like to a lot of times integrate yoga into foresight and goal setting, especially for entrepreneurs and having them like think about a future goal they have within their business and then stand or, you know, get into a yoga posture and hold that posture while they think about this thing and notice how they feel, but also having other people observe them and giving them feedback on how they think the other person's feeling as they're thinking about that thought. And what's really interesting is they get a lot of insight. Like people can immediately tell when that person's having a thought that doesn't align with their physiology. Right.
Right.
And it's really fascinating how that, like what Marcus is saying, this idea of embodiment and the importance of that. And I think it plays a lot in intuition as well. And do you have any real experiences with that, Marcus, for yourself or in your work, where you've seen how this idea of embodiment helps?
Yes, probably when you're doing yoga, you're relaxing. So your brain waves are also moving more into the deep alpha and theta levels of the brain. So you're probably starting to relax and move into those levels of the deeper psyche. And what I found from my experience is that if you can relax, you'll often get stronger intuitions, which may come through can come through a feeling through the body, maybe sometimes the images and sounds as well. And it's difficult to get those when your mind is too busy. Okay, so this is another problem with information overload. If you're too overloaded with information, then you don't get those intuitions so easily. I teach people intuition and intuitive intelligence and decision making based on it. I just tend to get them to relax and to breathe into their body, and then to get a sense of how they feel. And then some people have quite strongly visual or auditory, so they will get sounds and images and things that come into their minds. Mm-hmm. Some people just use the sense of the body. So, but there's a lot of things that people can, once they get whatever the prompt is, then they can move out and decide to use it in their life or the situation as they see fit.
Do people get the idea pretty quickly, or does it take a little bit of time?
Well, most people who come to me are already in this kind of category because they know the kind of person that I am. And it's about, you know, images, you know, there is something called what I call intentionality. And it's like when a knowing or an intention moves deeply into the body and you can really feel it. I'll tell you one story about this, even though it's a slightly mystical story. A few years ago in an organization, I had this, I wasn't being used very well in this organization, but I had this dream where I saw myself coming out of an elevator and moving off. And I was dressed in a tie and a coat, very formally. It was a very quick dream. It was just like that, and it was over. But when I woke up, I knew what it meant. It meant that I was going to be elevated in this organization into a position of greater responsibility. That's how I felt it was. Mm. But I could really feel that in my body. So I just said yes to it. This is how I function. I think I see it as a part of the mind, which is in a kind of a prayerful dialogue with the universe. Mm. And you can accept it or you can let it go. So I accepted it. And the interesting thing is nothing happened for about 2 months. And then suddenly the boss resigned, new boss came in, and I was elevated into a lot of positions of responsibility, but promoted very quickly, and my pay was given a pretty big jump as well. So it did turn out in that case to be based on an intuition and an insight, and it proved to be correct in that case.
Hmm. Any follow-up thoughts for you, Jerome?
Well, building on that, on the idea of feedback is what you're saying there. One of the, I've got a list of 10 ways to improve intelligence, individual intelligence in the Global Futures Intelligence System under the challenge. We have 15 global challenges. One is education. And one of the objectives we've had in there, future objectives of education, is to increase intelligence. Well, however you define intelligence, it doesn't need them, but we want it to go up rather than down. Anyway, one of the key elements, I remember getting this from the National Institute of Health, asking their view on increasing intelligence. And one of the key insights was responding to feedback, not just getting feedback. Because getting feedback, if that's all you get, that's information overload. Mm. But you got to respond to that feedback, even if the response is simply like, I don't want to look at that, or delete that idea, or but some response, because you're closing the synaptic connections in your brain this way. Mm-hmm. Well, not closing them, you're just adding them. So in the business about the intuition and so forth is notice the feedback. And I guess I was using with the rope business, or balancing it, in a sense, the body becomes a feedback system. Mm-hmm. But the important point here also, I'd like to have people understand when they create these early warning systems or environmental scanning systems or horizon scanning systems, one of the elements that I notice is almost always missing, and even in myself as well, is we're so good at figuring out how to get information, but we're lousy on responding. Mm. And that responding in a horizon scanning, any corporation has some way of, you know, keeping track of change, right? But do you have a way, not only keeping track of that change, but how do you force response? And back to the old Kuwait Oil Company, one of the techniques we had in there to forcing the response to the system was, let's say you're an executive and you're going off to some conference. You got to consult with the early warning system about what are the issues that conference can address that are questions that are important to the corporation. Then they go off and they don't get their money back from the expenses and all that until they file back into that system the responses to those things, getting that feedback in there. Mm. So it was a management technique to force feedback in the system.
Mm. Very interesting.
So Jerome, do you think that's because people have too much information, that they're kind of overwhelmed with data and are not able to act, or things change too fast, so therefore they're looking at more data 6 months down the track and they can still confuse?
Yeah, I think it's more the second one. Like, for example, that doing this stuff on the future of the virus for the Red Cross scenarios is I'm reading my little eyeballs off every day. I mean, there's so much stuff going on. I mean, you know, it's driving me nuts because I think there's got to be a new piece of information that I don't know, right? So I got to jump on that piece of information, jump on the next one. And I'm not doing the feedback as much as I should. So I'm not following my own advice well. But yeah, mm-hmm. I would say the second point is because there's so much going on, you just like, oh my God, there's something I don't know. Oh no, I better read this.
It reminded me too, again, going back to like martial arts example of how you have to be really, really aware of what, you know, what's relevant in that moment. You know, what's important information and what's not, because you can easily get distracted. Right. And right. Then next thing you know, you're on the ground. So
that's right.
To be able to respond to what's important.
Well, that brings up one of the elements in our mm-hmm. online system is we have news feeds. So let's say you're looking at the communicable disease challenge. So you have different sources. And whenever they have a press release or whatever new information, it automatically is put into this one area of news feeds. Hmm. So then what we can do is we go through the news feeds, or if there's we'll do a search like China, so it gives you all the news on China, on virus that day or whatever. But then out of all that information, news feeds, you're looking at it and there's we can do a right click and it gives us the option to put it in the scanning section, which is like the long-term memory of the brain. The news is like the short-term memory of the brain. Mm-hmm. So it forces us to actually make those distinctions. You know, when is something worth remembering and when mm-hmm. is it not worth remembering?
Yes. It's a problem we all, you know, I think no matter whether we're researchers or not, what is important and how deep do you go into it?
Right.
Yeah. And I think, and a lot of it too, I think comes back to that idea of intuition a lot of times, right? Sometimes you might see something and just click on it and save it, but you don't know why, but it just feels right.
Yes. And I do that myself. I use my intuition, but you got to be careful because a lot of these news organizations and information platforms, they want to activate your feeling. That's how they get you in. So there can be confusion between a valid intuition and something which is perhaps a manipulation from an external source.
Well, I want to wrap up here. What I'd love for you both to do is just give a, you know, final kind of final thoughts after this conversation, and love to start with Marcus.
Well, I guess if I was going to sum up what I said, I don't want to like, you know, push my own horse out there all the time. I think what Jerome is doing, I think is fantastic. And to be honest, I didn't know as much about Jerome's work as I should have before this podcast. And I was left with the task of trying to go through many years of work. So I'm in great admiration of people who are out there working with multiple stakeholders and in multiple spheres. It must be very, very satisfying and very difficult. And my sphere is probably a little bit narrower. And but I think what Jerome's doing is certainly every bit as valid as what I'm doing. I believe in the importance of balancing different ways of knowing. Big data good, as long as we can get it in perspective or put it into a framework which is intelligible, rational, empirical, all very good, I think. as long as it doesn't, one particular way of knowing, if it's applied in the wrong space, which is a category error, then it can be a problem. And when people are developing their own lives, perhaps, the intuitive is extremely important. And embodiment, I think, or what I call embodied presence, I think is one way that we can begin to negotiate our way around the future of the internet, because if we're more embodied and more relaxed, then it will help address a lot of the problems we're seeing with, you know, anxiety and disembodiment we're seeing in the population, I think. So that's about it for me.
Yeah, thanks, Marcus. And Jerome?
Oh my. Let's take a guy like Elon Musk. I think whatever anybody thinks about him, I think most people would say he's intelligent and he's a leader. One of the things I really like about his style of leadership is that, as best I can tell, he looks around and say, that needs to be done. Wow, that's impossible. So who knows the most about it? There might be four people in the world. So he essentially hires or gets those four people and says, okay, how do we do this? What's the next step? And he has pushed the envelope in completely different areas. Mm-hmm. I mean, financial systems is a lot different than a car. And a car is a whole lot different than a spaceship. I mean, this guy has gone leadership across many different areas. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the areas of leadership is what ought to be done that isn't being done, even if it's impossibly difficult. Who knows the most about it? Okay, put together the team. Because if they know the most about it, maybe they want to do it too. And maybe no one's asking. I remember there's a guy named Ted Taylor, who was actually the mechanic on the atomic bomb years ago. And we asked him about some stuff on the lunar minerals and space development and so forth. And he did some calculations, says, wow, this is really cool. And we said, like, why hadn't you ever done it? He says, no one ever asked me. I think there are tons of people out there like old Ted Taylor that no one ever asked him to do something. And so one role of leadership we didn't quite mention is, you know, do that far out thing, but pick those people that are closest to it. Because if we do the normal thing, like what's next, and then you do the normal analysis, you get the normal response, which is not necessarily leadership of the future.
Great point, Jerome. And the final question I'd like to ask everyone is, what's one word you would like to leave, you know, future intelligent leadership? Marcus, one word.
I guess I'd have to go with embodiment.
Embodiment. And Jerome?
Integrity.
Integrity. Great. Well, thank you both for your time, energy, your insights. Really enjoyed the conversation with you today.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Tyler and Jerome. It's been great.
Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more Futures Intelligent Leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about, so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha.